The Duct Tape Marketing Podcast is brought to you by GoToWebinar, web events and online meetings made easy. Visit GoToWebinar.com and start your free 30-day trial today. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is your host, John Jantz, and my guest today is Scott Belsky. He is the CEO and founder of the Behance Network, a leading platform for creatives, and he's also the author of Making Ideas Happen, Overcoming the Obstacles Between Vision and Reality. So, Scott, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know, there's a this is on your website to with the book, and I'm sure it's scattered amongst other places, but this idea of not the the world, I guess, is not about ideas, but it's about making ideas happen. I have to tell you, when I speak, a lot of times it's small business owners or startups, and it never fails. Somebody comes up to me and says, "I want to tell you my idea, but you know, you have to promise to keep it a secret." And I've probably irritated a few people over the years, going, "You know what? You could tell this whole room. Nobody's going to do anything with it anyway." You know,
right?
Because it is all about execution, and I think that's a lot of times there's all these great ideas that people have, but nothing really happens unless you execute them.
Yeah, I mean, well, listen, I always say the same thing that you say to people. I say, first of all, if your idea is so easily replicated and stolen, then it's probably not a good idea to begin with,
right?
Because as soon as you share it, you know, then it's gone, right? So, but I also tell them that, and you know, and some of the stuff that I learned over the research for this book is that a lot of people swear on the benefit of sharing ideas liberally.
Yeah.
You know, one of the people we met along the way was Chris Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine and the prolific author in his own right. And he talked about how every time he has an inkling of an idea, he just puts it up on his blog, you know, whether it's a new book he wants to write or a new product, you know, he's thinking of developing for Wired or elsewhere. He just puts it out there, you know, for a few reasons. One, he wants to see whether people gain traction with it, and if they hate it or love it, or if they ignore it, you know, that gives him a lot of data. Also, he finds that if he doesn't put those ideas out there, he's unlikely to be held accountable to them. You know, if no one's asking him what's the latest on that idea you shared last week, then he's unlikely to follow through. And so his perspective is, share ideas liberally or else they're never going to happen to begin with. It's very similar to what you said.
You know, that's a great point too. I know in, you know, maybe it's even writing a blog post or something, you know, not even a huge project. I'm always amazed sometimes when I get feedback or ideas from people, how much more energy I get around the idea too.
Yeah. So it looks like this natural, you know, almost Darwinian response. It's like the ideas that gain the most traction from our community are the ones we end up spending the most energy on and the ones that succeed the most.
Yeah. Well, so the Behance platform, is that the current best term for it? I think it actually is. I think it started out as, it's interesting, I think my observation, and I could be way off, hopefully not, but my observation is it started very much as a community in the sort of typical fashion. But it has grown to be so much more than that, and I think there's actually, you're in fact, I should write a blog post about the Behance Network, because I think that you have a model of community, whether you planned it or it happened organically, that I think so many people would love to have, because it appears to me that so much of what you've grown there has happened because the community made it happen, and boy, that has got to be the clearest sign of a healthy community.
Yeah, listen, you know, the Behance Network is, we have focused on it being a really effective promotional platform. And because as you know, better than probably anyone else, is that if you don't showcase what you're doing effectively, you know, you're going to be ignored. And but there's an appropriate way and an inappropriate way to showcase your talent. And so we were always trying to figure out, like, the balance. You know, how do we help creative professionals around the world across industries, when they do projects for clients or for themselves or whatever, what's the most efficient way for these people to put it out there, to get data on who's seeing it and how many people are seeing it, and really track as it spreads throughout the web? So that's why we call it a platform rather than a community or a network, typically, just because we think that it's really that. When you put stuff up there, it automatically shows up in all these other networks you're a part of and galleries and stuff like that. And if people really like it, then more people start to see it. And so there's that natural mechanism of spread.
Well, but I guess what I see there is also so many other tools, though, to help them. Not certainly the, you're right, the marketing and being seen is a big deal, but there's all the productivity tools and really the advice and the tips and the stuff. So it's really about them. It's kind of about the whole business, and I think that's a part that sometimes is missing.
Yeah, well, that's true, and we started with the Behance Network and Action Method, this series of paper products and online tools for productivity, and we realized that there was something big missing.
Yeah.
That all of this research that we were doing and the interviews and all that stuff was not being collected and presented in some sort of think tank that people could just turn to start to critique the way that they do stuff. So I think that's what you're referring to, this thing that we now call the 99%
Right.
at the 99%.com. That's like kind of become like a, a think tank, if you will, for execution in the creative world. We feature best practices and stuff, that are written and found by us and also by others. I know we've linked to stuff that you've written before as well. So it's become a collection of sorts.
Well, let's move a little bit to the book because obviously the, well, I shouldn't say obviously, in many cases, books like this are an outpouring of what you've learned along the way here inside of this network. So the Behance Network is primarily folks engaged in obviously creative work. I mean, is that who the book's for?
Yeah, the book is for people with ideas, people who have lots of ideas and are frustrated with the fact that they're just not making them happen as much as they'd like. And it's born out of that frustration. I mean, that's really what the crux of this business was to begin with. And so the book's really targeted at people who have lots of ideas or generate ideas for a living and want to focus more on the execution side. So the one thing the book does not talk about is how to be inspired, how to be creative. There's nothing about real innovation in this book. It's an execution book. And it's all about the best practices that executors use, the people who make ideas happen again and again and again, whereas most people don't. We were trying to figure out what those people do right.
See, and I guess my point is when you say it's people who make ideas, my belief is that everybody in business should be. That's actually job
Yeah.
number one is creating and making ideas happen. So it's really, I guess that was the point I was trying to make is that some people might assume this is for
Yep.
graphic designers, for instance. And I
Yep.
really think that this book is an awesome business owner book who is actually pushing innovation and marketing and every other creative thing forward, whether they know it or not.
Thanks, John. I mean, I'm glad you see it that way. I feel like, I mean, a lot of the people that we profile in this book. I mean, yes, some of them are entrepreneurs and people who run small businesses. Some of them are like the core creatives that we would call them, like the designers and the filmmakers and whatever. But I think that if you can help, especially creative people who are just drowning in ideas, become more organized and execute better, then you can leverage those best practices for everyone. So it's kind of like focusing on the people who needed the help the most. And then knowing that those insights will be helpful to everyone. But I agree with you. I mean, we all have a responsibility. I mean, ideas also include solving problems. I mean, every small business leader has problems they're trying to solve. They're trying to generate new ways of doing things. And when you're doing that, you're also trying to stay afloat. I mean, one of the things we've realized is, especially this day and age with email and Twitter and Facebook and voicemails and all these other things incoming, we're like starting to live this era of what I've come to call reactionary workflow, where it's like you're just trying to get clear your collective inboxes every day, and you really can't be proactive and focus on those long-term goals and ideas or things you want to change in your business, because you're always just reacting every day. And so the question is, how do people not become, overwhelmed by the gravitational pull of operations? And how do they stay generating and executing ideas in their business?
Sometimes when I'm being my most cynical self, and my kids will ask me what I do for a living, and I will tell them I delete email. That's what I do for a living. But you really do cover in this book. I'm looking for the exact quote: finding the time to push the big, meaningful ideas forward. Getting rid of all that other stuff so you can do that. So, I guess let's get practical. How do you do that?
Yeah. So practically speaking, in conquering reactionary workflow, what did we see people do? So some people literally created windows of non-stimulation in their day where they would close or minimize any of these incoming inboxes And then they would focus on that other list that they have, not the to-do list with all the stuff that's urgent on it, but that other short list of kind of long-term goals or things that they're trying to think about that are more broad, not as minute. And then they literally spend that window of non-stimulation focusing on those things and thinking about it. So in one case, there's a gentleman we interviewed by the name of Kiers Fox who runs a big marketing consultancy. And between the hours of 7 and 10 in the morning, he doesn't even open his email. He minimizes everything, and he just does research. Research on things his clients are asking about, that he's been thinking about. Now, he always says if he were to open his email, he would the rest of the day be in reactionary workflow mode. But it's that preservation of that window that he thinks, you know, keeps him and gives him his competitive edge. So, you know, that's certainly one tip.
Let me just finish up on that point. So you're saying the way people have to view it is like an appointment. You know, here's my strategic, creative, whatever, goal-driven appointment each day.
Yes, there's this. Exactly. That well, it would be an appointment on your calendar, literally, right?
Yeah, right.
Where it would just be this focus mode, you know, this window mode where you know that email, text, Twitter, Facebook, phone calls, instant messenger, everything's off, and you are being proactive with your energy rather than being reactive and responding to everything that's coming in. So that's point number one: is making it a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be ritualized, or you're not going to do it.
Right.
Point number two is thinking in this way of two lists. You know, having kind of the to-do stuff, which is obviously everyone needs a to-do list of sorts, but then another list that's more, you know, bigger things. Now, one of those things might be family, you know, for mm-hmm. certain people doing the major things with their family, the house move, whatever, you know, the stuff that's important versus urgent needs to be treated separately. And just a quick third point for a lot of us on, you know, that are listening to this, leaders of small businesses who really care a lot about any problem and any, you know, anything that comes up, we want to take care of it ourselves. And one of the problems I noticed in this research was that we have the tendency to hoard urgent items to ourselves,
yes.
even if someone else can do them. And you know this, like if something comes in and someone's mad about something, your tendency is just to take care of yourself, even if it's someone else's job.
Mm.
And so can we have the discipline to not hoard urgent items and consume our day with them? You know, something that's urgent doesn't necessarily mean it's complex. It's just urgent. We need to spend our time as leaders focus on the things that are important.
Yeah, that's, you know, I've worked with thousands of small business owners, and I think you're absolutely right that is a very, very common attribute. And I think it comes as much as anything from so many folks start this thing and everything is theirs, and letting go of anything actually is sometimes a challenge.
Very hard.
Yeah.
And it takes a discipline.
So you also talk about, I don't know if we want to call this a myth or not, but the idea that this creative big thinker sits alone in a room and creates all these ideas, and that you know, a lot of what you talk about in the book is you know, understanding how to leverage a community. We were talking, I think, before we got started here about the idea of feedback and you know, really getting your ideas going because you shared them. And so I think the whole idea of the lonely genius, I think, is somewhat a myth that you want to make go away. This halftime break is brought to you by Constant Contact. Constant Contact helps small businesses and nonprofits build great customer relationships with email marketing, event marketing, and online surveys. Visit them today at ConstantContact.com and sign up for your free 60-day trial.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, unfortunately, great ideas are born and killed in isolation every day. And I like to also say that there are probably more half-written novels in the world than there are novels. And, you know, we've all had ideas for businesses and restaurants and other things that we want to start, and they've never gained traction. And, of course, involving your constituents, your community, and this includes, obviously, family and friends and past colleagues. And I mean, these are the people that give our ideas steam. You know, they provide the feedback. Sometimes, you know, one of the things we found was that there are a lot of people we met that had a great idea that they were developing for quite some time, but never really made progress on it until they noticed competition in their community. They came across someone else with the same idea, and they were like, "Oh my God, I got to get my act together and do this." And that was sometimes a catalyst for action and execution. So community plays both expected and unexpected roles in helping us get stuff done. But one of the things that I would want to say, you know, there's a lot of talk about transparency these days, right, and also privacy, and, you know, so people want to protect the privacy, and Facebook is always dealing with privacy issues and all this stuff. But then you also have to question the value of transparency. There's a real positive value. If everyone knows how you are spending your time, and, you know, and the projects you're working on and the goals that you have, your community will do wonders for you. They will start critiquing you. They will start holding you accountable. They will start connecting you with other people who have similar ideas and interests. And, I mean, so transparency is one of those things we noticed across the board that a lot of new age leaders are doing now, of small businesses and large businesses alike. They're letting people look at their calendars. They're letting people look at, you know, their thoughts through Twitter and blogging and stuff. So people should use transparency as a way to make sure that the community sees, you know, where you're spending your energy and can get involved.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think there are a lot of people that always that really gravitate towards trying to make connections and get, you know, people introduced to people and make referrals and things. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think if they're sort of taught, you know, here's what I'm looking for, you know, here's who's ideal, here's what I'm working on, or at least it's very easy for them to see that, I think that you're right. It probably really facilitates that process.
I agree.
I was going to say I'd love to pick on my wife on this one sometimes. Actually, she's picking on me, but I get to pick on her in this particular platform. I like to start projects, and I don't so much like to finish them. So you know, you talk about this project plateau, and I think a lot of entrepreneur, a lot of idea people love the idea, but they get bored with the actual doing it. And so, what advice? Yeah. What advice do you have for the finish?
Yes, well, you know, just to illustrate this major problem for the listeners, the energy at the point of conception of a new idea in your business is really high, and that energy fuels you to write it down and to tell people and to get started on it and to start taking action. But then as the project, you know, continues, you start to lose that energy and excitement, and you get lost in what I've come to call the project plateau, where it's really, really easy to get distracted. And what we tend to do to escape that project plateau is we create a new idea and we leave a project, you know, abandoned halfway done. And so you're asking kind of how do you escape that process?
Yeah.
So one of the things that, especially amongst entrepreneurs, is I kind of call it short-circuiting your reward system. Because if you think about it, we're typically, you know, engaged in a project by getting feedback, you know, whether and also getting paid. And, yeah, you know, it's easy when you have a client who's paying you a monthly fee and then it just kind of keeps you on the project and you keep continuing because you get the near-term reward. But, of course, with long-term, with most bold ideas, there's no near-term reward. It's always like a long-term initiative. So what do you do to kind of trick yourself into staying engaged with this project enough to complete it? We've seen all kinds of things. A lot of people obviously create milestones, but they do it in a very creative way that keeps people kind of fascinated and engaged. They use things, whether it's like Google Analytics or other measurement tools, to give them some sort of progress in their project, kind of early premature indications of progress. Maybe they haven't finished yet. Maybe they haven't made it profitable yet. But there's still something that can keep them and their team engaged and feel like they're getting some sort of acknowledgement or reward. Some people threaten themselves. They literally set up little mental agreements that if they don't get a certain thing done by a certain milestone, a certain target date, that they're going to have to, you know, fill in the blank with something really embarrassing that you really don't want to do.
Well, that sounds downright barbaric, actually.
There's one woman I interviewed who told me that I think she was writing a screenplay and she kept putting it off and she couldn't, and she said that she promised herself, and this was a woman in her late 30s, that if she did not have the screenplay done by a certain date, that she would have to call her old high school guidance counselor and talk to him about how she had really, you know, ended up disappointed in her life. And the awkwardness of having that call with someone she had not talked to in 20 or 30 years or whatever was so shocking to her that, you know, she got it done.
Okay, I guess whatever it takes, huh? I'm going to read a couple short statements that I think I'd love for you to kind of fill in the what will probably be short, somewhat short answers. You talk about reducing all projects to just three primary components. So what are those three?
The three components of any projects in life are action steps, things that start with verbs, things that are actionable, mm-hmm. back burner items, which are the things you want to come back to in the future. You know, the budget's not there, the client's not interested now, things that may be actionable someday, but not anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And then the reference items. Static notes, the attachments, and all that other stuff that kind of builds up on our desk but seldom is referred back to.
So how do you keep all of those together and organized? I guess that's what some of your paper products and online tools are about, aren't they?
Well, the premise here is that you approach every discussion, everything in life, with this mentality of capturing the action steps and the back burner items and the references. The key piece here is the following. Keeping them separate is important, first of all. Mm-hmm. The action steps need to start with verbs and remain separate from everything else. Actions, you know, and this kind of goes back to, like, getting things done and David Allen's belief that quick action should just be done quickly, and then long-term action should be tracked over time through some sort of system.
Yeah.
I suggest that it's by project rather than by context, since today, you know, at work is at home, and it's easier to kind of manage everything by project.
Yeah.
With back burner items, we've seen a lot of people have a ritual where they'll have once a month, they'll revisit that back burner document. It might be like a running Microsoft Word document on their computer, and they'll print it out, and they will go through it, and they will, you know, cross certain things out that seem ridiculous. They will keep certain things on that are still kind of back burner items that they might want to remember in the future. But then sometimes they will find back burner items from, you know, months, if not years ago, that are suddenly relevant, and they'll turn it into action steps.
Yeah.
And one of the things to think about, go ahead.
No, finish that thought.
Yeah, just one last thing I was just going to say is, you know, with this mentality in mind, we have to start questioning the value of meetings and how we're spending our time. If you go into a meeting with a group of people and you leave without anything actionable, just references and just back burner items, you have to wonder whether that meeting should have been a voicemail or an email. You know, meetings are very costly, and we all know this, that meetings are, you know, there's a love-hate relationship with them, and this is maybe a new way of measuring the value of meetings with action steps.
Yeah, that you won't get any pushback from me on that. I'm unemployable, unemployable because I won't go to meetings now. All right, encourage fighting within your team. What do you mean by that?
Well, when people are really passionate about a topic and they vehemently disagree with the decision that's being made, what happens in most teams is that people debate it, and, you know, let's say you have three or four people debating a solution to a problem and what's going to be done. And then eventually you have one or two people who are like, you know what, I don't care anymore. This is just getting too heated.
Yeah.
You know, it's not worth it to me, whatever. And that apathy kills the best solution, you know, from happening. It really hurts the team. It hurts the user, the customer. And so the best practice that we've seen in a lot of creative teams is to keep up the fight. Is when people are vehemently disagreeing and one person starts to be apathetic and starts to give in, you actually should encourage them to stand their ground, because it's the only way that their perspective and that kind of design space of solutions is going to be explored. And fighting, we typically don't want to have confrontation, and we try to keep everything friendly in teams, but we found that a lot of teams have a culture where fighting is okay. And they recognize that when they're getting heated up, that means that there are a lot of potential solutions to explore, and the best leaders keep people engaged, and they fight apathy ruthlessly.
Yeah, because there's some people that just don't like confrontation, so they just as soon not have their idea heard than have it maybe shouted back at them.
people disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked a little bit about half of this, but I want to know a little more about the second half. Seek competition and share ideas liberally. What do you mean by seek competition?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, so we talked about sharing ideas liberally and just how important that is. And the competition piece is, it's a force. I mean, we cannot ignore the value of the force of competition in our community, you know, meaning the people that are in our space, in our industry. Competition keeps us on our toes. Competition ultimately serves the end user, the customer, because everyone's constantly iterating and improving their product to have it be better. And so I really have seen, you know, I've seen a lot of teams where, you know, in industries where they seek competition. They literally recognize the value of it, and it sounds crazy, but they think it's the way to keep their competitive edge and to have a track record of execution. They have their competitors. So if you're running a small business and you try to ignore the competition and purposely never discuss them in the workplace and kind of almost pretend they don't exist because you don't want to demoralize people by being scared, you're doing the wrong thing. You actually need to find these people, embrace, you know, the fact that they exist, and keep track of them.
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point. I find with a lot of small businesses, it's not that they're really afraid of competition. They're not in an environment where they go head to head necessarily. So in some cases, they can't really even identify their competition. And I think you're right. Actually, having a strong enemy sometimes is what really kind of rallies the team.
Yeah, and for the benefit of the industry, it's always going to help.
Yeah, so Making Ideas Happen can be purchased pretty much anywhere they sell books, but have you also created a site just for the book, or is it inside of the network, or where would you send people?
Yeah, if you go to Making Ideas Happen is the name of the book, and if you go to makingideashappen.com, it redirects you to a page in our think tank where the book is prominently displayed and has all the links to order it. It's coming out officially on April 15th, and you know, obviously people are pre-ordering now, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join me. I know that you had been doing some traveling, and I think you jumped right out of a meeting to do this interview, so I know how that can go. So I certainly appreciate it, and I know that the book will do well, and hopefully we will speak again soon.
Thanks again.
All right. This episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast was brought to you by GoToWebinar, where you can increase your reach and have unlimited webinars for one low rate. Visit GoToWebinar.com and start your free 30-day trial today.